Chef Michael Smith has a ball of fresh pasta dough that he's flattening in an electric roller at his restaurant in the Crossroads.
So this chunk of pasta, we just keep folding it and running it through until it creates this long sheet that's roughly 4.5 feet, 5 feet long.
It's a light green color, which is no accident. This is pistachio pasta. They make it with pistachio oil as well as fresh flour that they grind here in the kitchen.
We're going to do it tonight with octopus and yellow tomatoes and some chili flakes. We don't do a lot of volume in our restaurant, so we're able to create these specialty pastas by hand every day. You know, the more you get into the details of something and the intricacies of something, then all of a sudden the game changes.
And the game is definitely changing at Michael Smith's restaurant, an institution for the Kansas City food scene and a Crossroads staple for the past 10 years. At a time when a lot of chefs might stick with what worked, Michael Smith is embarking on a new concept inspired by a trip to Italy. He's making his version of Tuscan cuisine, hence pistachio pasta. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and the chef is with me in the studio now. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Congratulations on 10 years.
Thank you.
Pistachio pasta sounds amazing.
Well, flour, dough, is a great carrier for lots of great flavors. And so we put squid ink, tomato, spinach, arugula, pistachios.
As I was just hinting, you are not doing a victory lap to celebrate your 10th anniversary. You have a new concept you're trying out. And this might be a little bit confusing. I mean, it's not a new restaurant, just something you are doing at Michael Smith.
We're kind of calling it the sabbatical. You know, people understand that word and kind of what it means that you're in your profession and maybe you've reached a level and then you're kind of allowed to take some time to do something else that you want to turn left and do.
And so you're calling this Finding Guido?
Finding Guido because it's the, what's the sepler? What's the dot, dot, dot term?
You know, ellipse?
The ellipse. So meaning continuation of a thought or continuation of a thing. And so this is the continuation of Michael Smith moving forward. What's next? And so Finding Guido is our sort of way to say Italian.
When you use the word Guido, what are you referencing?
Well, there's wine by the name of Guido. There's a cookbook by the name of Guido. And there's a restaurant, but there's plenty of restaurants in Italy called Guido. And specifically, there's a one-star Michelin restaurant in Piedmont called Guido. And we ate there several years ago. And it was just a fun, interesting, really good dinner.
So do I understand correctly that there's this trip to Italy where you went to this restaurant was sort of transformative for you?
Well, I've been to Italy many, many times, and I love Italy. But on this particular trip, it was 7 days in the Amalfi Coast and then 7 days in Piedmont. And this restaurant in Piedmont called Guido is beloved by many people, opened in the 60s. And it was just very difficult to find in this little hill town, you know, when you're driving all over and things are crazy. And then once we find it, we can't get in because there's all these gates. It was on the University of Gastronomia in Italy. It's where the slow food movement started. And so it was just this sort of laughable, comical problems to get into the restaurant. And then, you know, when we finally did all of that, in the rain, moving cars because we weren't parked in the correct spots and just crazy stuff, we finally had this great dinner and they were very generous and very welcoming and the food was awesome. And so I just thought, I need to do it. I've been thinking about it for a while and I just decided I needed to do it.
Describe the food you ate during this amazing meal, because even though it sounds like this is something that had been on your mind for a long time, if this meal was the turning point, it must have been a pretty great meal.
Well, most of the foods that are going to be served in any Piedmontese restaurant are going to be pretty much the same year-round, although they have, you know, seasonal vegetables and things. But the raviolini, these agnolotti that they have there that are incredible, and they're stuffed with all kinds of things like braised, it's generally braised meat, braised veal, beef, pork, maybe rabbit, and all the vegetables that are braised with it, cheese, and all of this is ground up and then put in these tiny, tiny little pillows called agnolotti, or these raviolinis. Those are incredible. We had one at every restaurant.
Like tiny raviolis?
Like tiny.
When you say braised, for people who don't cook, can you describe that process?
That
what
means,
it means?
So if you're braising a piece of meat, that means you would probably sear it, either heavy or light, depending on what kind of chef you are. But and then a little bit of liquid, about 3/4 of the way up to the meat, with all these vegetables in there, like carrots and, you know, leeks and onions.
So it's that like soft, juicy
yes.
meat.
And then you would bake it in the oven, you know, at 300 degrees for a few hours, and it just breaks everything down, and it's really tender and beautiful.
What is the history of this restaurant? Does it have a particular history that speaks to you?
Well, Guido started in the 60s by this husband and wife, and they've moved several locations over the years, but they just have been there, and they just do the food they do, and they're true to it, and it's just quality, and they hand make their pastas. And the gelato at the end, they bring out a tray. I'm assuming it's frozen. I wasn't really paying attention, but there's this cloud, you know, a 2-foot by 2-foot cloud of frozen vanilla gelato.
Wait, no, a cloud. I'm not quite picturing something that seems like real life.
So, you know, the whipped cream commercials where all the, you know, so the Cool Whip and all the little shapes and these sort of swirls that are in this Cool Whip commercial sometimes.
Yeah.
It looks like that on this huge platter, but it's frozen gelato. And they come over with this kind of paddle and everyone gets a plate and they just scoop it right onto your plate. And now you have a little bitty miniature cloud on your plate. And it was, it was like, oh my God, this is the best gelato I've ever had.
So you were on this trip as just a matter of course. You go periodically on vacation, and this wasn't like a vacation where you were on a quest for a new kind of food?
We were on a quest to eat food. All of our vacations, there's no shopping, and my wife doesn't appreciate that, but all vacations are a quest for food.
So when you talk about making Italian food in your restaurant, I mean, is there a particular challenge in that for you?
Well, not necessarily as a chef, but I mean, I'm not. Michael Smith doesn't say Italian. So,
no, it does not.
So that's, you know, you have to. That's sort of a hurdle, probably. But I think, you know, I'm no expert in Italian cooking, but I have a passion for it. I love it. We don't do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people in a volume in our restaurants, so we can do more creative. We can be hands on more, and so I think that allows us to win that battle.
You can grind your own flour.
Yes, but you don't need very much. I'm not grinding, you know, 25 pounds of all-purpose flour every day. I'm grinding like farro and red winter wheat and things that'll add a nuance to the pasta, because you always need a semolina or, you know, some kind of 00 flour to make the pasta. But you can add a flavoring agent, which could be a flour and or, you know, squid ink or pistachios.
Some people might consider it risky to change up your identity after 10 years. I mean, when something has been such a success the way it is.
Well, you're right. You know, that's why the .. you know, Guido, finding Guido. I think because, I mean, I'm going to be 57 this year. And so I've got maybe 15 years of cooking left. I mean, hardcore working in the kitchen when I'm 70, I'm not so sure. So I'm like, okay, we did 10 years. It's okay if I turn left, and I want to cook what I want to cook, and I want to bring it to Kansas City, and I want to just keep going and be happy in the kitchen and cook my passion. And that's kind of where, that's kind of what I thought I was. You know, if you're 2 years into a concept and you have to change because you think maybe it's not working, well, then that's a failure. But, you know, after 10 years, I can say, okay, we did that. And I've been kind of cooking the same sort of style of food for the last 25 years.
Describe that style, because I have eaten at both of your restaurants, Extra Virgin and Michael Smith, and I think it's hard to, like, pin a category on the style of food you do, even though it's recognizable.
Well, I tend to agree, and I've always struggled with that in terms of, because I've always played with Asian ingredients, although we do that way less in our restaurants now than ever before. But it's Mediterranean, and so I always feel like as long as I'm kind of staying in the same country on a plate, I'm okay with it being from Latin America or you know, Italy or France or Spain. I just want to stay fairly true, and I've always felt like my...
So it's not quite fusion. It's more like one country, one plate?
Yeah, I mean, I just want the flavors to make sense on each plate. And so, you know, and I've always been sort of Mediterranean, although we've done other things, but I've been Mediterranean the whole time. And so it's whether it's Spain, Italy, France, you know, I've done Turkish weddings, I've done Azerbaijan weddings, but their food, you would realize, is once you start cooking and getting into it, it's very similar to Mediterranean cooking.
What is it about Mediterranean cooking that really draws you in?
Well, I think what happened was, you know, I went to France in 1985, and I thought I was going to be cooking this northern French, you know, all the classic dishes. And I ended up in Nice following a chef, and I thought, this is sort of Italian cooking. And I was disappointed. I wasn't sure, but I didn't know what I was looking for. But then when I spent almost 5 years in Provence, and you can't help but love the cuisine of the sun. And so the cuisine of the sun applies to Spain, Italy, France.
What do you mean by that, cuisine of the sun?
Vegetables, fennel, onions, peppers, basil, herbs, oregano. I mean, all of these foods that grow in the sun countries. And then they're going to be, you know, usually if they're down by water, now you've got fish, incredible fishes and seafood.
You know, we were talking about the risk of changing the identity of your restaurant, Michael Smith, or at least taking a sabbatical from its identity 10 years in. But some people might have seen your menu as risky 10 years ago, too. I think this is actually at Extra Virgin, but the pig ear appetizer got a lot of press, I recall. I mean, you've been using animal parts that it's become trendy to do this very recently. But at the time, I think there was still kind of an ooh factor. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. When we first opened Extra Virgin, we put something on the menu. Food group was titled For the Adventurous, I think. And because I've always loved those, I started cooking pig ears in 1983 at King Supers, this supermarket in Denver, Colorado. This butcher, I worked the overnight shift, and this butcher took me around at 2 a.m. and we would cook pig ears and make mustard. It was weird. It was like southern food. But it was yellow mustard, raw onion, white bread, and cooked pig ears. We ate those sandwiches at 3 a.m. That's weird.
Why were you doing that at 3 a.m.?
Well, at the time, in 83, I'd graduated from college, and I was trying to save to go to France. And so I was working as many jobs as I could. And that's, you know, kind of when that whole movement in the supermarket started about prepared foods, all the stuffed chicken breasts and the kebabs and all that. And so they were hiring cooks and chefs around the city, and I was one of them. So it was kind of a second job.
Tell me more about your background. I mean, you are a big name in Kansas City's food scene, but I haven't heard a lot about the journey that brought you there. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in places like Lubbock, Texas, and Amarillo, and Tulsa, and Phoenix, Arizona, and South Dakota.
I mean, places like, why so many?
My mother was in the restaurant business, and she ran a restaurant called Zyder Z, which was exactly like a Red Lobster. And as she moved around the company and got promoted, we would move. We moved almost every year.
What was the food like in your childhood? I mean, did you have some consistency in that through those moves, or did it change from place to place?
No, it was very consistent. It was my mother was a good cook, but she worked jobs raising two kids by herself. So we would buy TV dinners, 30 of them, eat them, save the containers, and then on Sundays, my mother would cook new TV dinner food, put it in the same exact compartments within that tinfoil platter, and we'd refreeze them. And then we would eat those. My sister and I would eat those during the week.
So she made you like customized TV dinners?
Yeah, meatloaf, chicken fried, whatever it was, the same sort of stuff, only she would cook it. So it was pretty interesting.
That is a really inventive way of handling like making fresh food for your kids, but also being a person who can't be doing that day in and day out.
Correct. Yeah, it was pretty cool. But at the same time, we were eating canned corns, canned beans, canned everything. I didn't even know. I mean, when I started working for this French restaurant in Denver, my chef was looking at me like I'm an idiot because he's thinking this food grows on a farm. And not that I didn't really know that, but I never saw food on a farm. In fact, I went to Tennessee with some people that one time when I was maybe 16, and we stayed at this guy's house, and he took me out to his little farm. I mean, his backyard garden. He said, come into my garden, which was 5 acres. And he gave me a tomato off the vine, and he said, eat this like an apple. And I did. I mean, that sounds like one of those corny epiphany stories, but I ate this tomato and I'd never tasted a tomato like that.
What was different about it? Can you describe it?
Well, now that I, you know, remember back and think, well, a 5x6 frozen, a tomato that comes out of in the winter out of a box tastes like, you know, chalk and has no juice really. And very lack of, you know, the depth of flavor. And so now you have
like air between the flesh instead of that like thick pulpy juice.
Spongy, you know. And so now you have heirloom tomatoes everywhere and these beautiful red tomatoes and they're juicy and they're just, the depth just keeps going. Same with peaches. You know, you taste them from the farm and you're just, the depth just keeps going.
What got you interested in food to begin with? Because it doesn't sound like you were already wanting, you were already working for a chef when you had this epiphany you're describing.
Yeah, you know, we grew up, you know, we didn't have a lot of resources growing up. And so I wanted to eat. We didn't starve. We, you know, we weren't hungry, but certainly food was a goal of mine. And so I just thought, I can work in the restaurant business and travel, I thought, and eat. I can always eat. I mean, I got a psych degree, and so I got a college degree thinking, okay, maybe I'll do something else. But I ended up in the restaurant business.
It's so funny because you hear people talking today about trying to cultivate a refined palate, and it sounds like it was actually the absence of access to those refined foods. Refined, I guess, is the wrong word. Like those sort of, I don't know, this whole wide range of flavors that's out there. Like you wanted to find that because you didn't have it.
Yeah. And my mother, she was single. And so she would periodically date men, and they would take her away to a long weekend at the Fontainebleau in Miami or some resort in Arizona. And when she would come back and talk about that, I lived in like a trailer park in Lubbock, Texas, you know. And so I'm dreaming and thinking, there's something else out there. And so I didn't really know what it was, and I didn't know how to find it. And all the little towns that I lived in didn't have it. And frankly, when I ran into this chef in Denver, Colorado at this French restaurant, I backpacked through Europe after college, and that opened my mind huge. That was huge for me to travel. That was huge. Nobody in my family even would think of doing that.
It seems like there's so much, I don't know, desire behind food for you, and that you're still kind of going on these journeys to other parts of the world and even calling your next chapter. We focused on the Guido part, but not the finding part, like that you're off looking for something.
Well, I do have to tell you, I my mother always asks me, where do you get all of this energy, or what drives, and I don't know what drives me, but I've been here 22 or 23 years in Kansas City, and I've had a great career and great followers, but I feel like I'm still trying to make it. I'm hungry every day. I go to my restaurant every day, and I'm trying to make good food, and I want to learn, and I want to mentor all my young cooks. So I'm always searching. So I think I'm always trying to find something.
When you are trying to find like your own approach to Italian food, can you talk to me about some of the ingredients or techniques that you've really connected with?
I think I've learned over the years from different chefs and just working with different chefs at fundraisers and seeing techniques in restaurants. You know, I want to extract flavors. I want to reduce the flavor of that, sometimes with cooking and sometimes without cooking. I want to dehydrate something to increase the flavor. I want to char the herbs and then make a salsa verde. Charred gives them just another layer of flavor. Every time you do something to a piece of food, you know, whether it's charring it, roasting it, seasoning it, you develop another layer of flavor. And so when you put all those together, then you just create this amalgamy of flavor that people don't necessarily know they're looking for, but they can't describe it, but it's delicious.
Can you take me to a moment of epiphany in your kitchen as you've been on this journey?
Well, I was just talking with a recent chef of mine about Paul Bertoli has a book called Cooking by Hand, and I've had that book for a long time, and I don't read them because I'm a picture guy, but he was talking about sugo, and I always thought sugo is this sauce. Sugo is kind of a red meat sauce, or it could be brown, but you know, this sauce for pasta has meat in it and other stuff. And he's like, no, the sugo where you're creating these bits, and he's starting to talk about this sugo that I'm thinking, what? He goes, oh yeah, it's in Paul Bertoli's book, and I'm like, oh, so I go back and I read it. And so this guy is taking chicken, pork, beef, veal, any of these bits and pieces and bones, and cooking them in this big rondeau until they caramelize on the bottom. Well, that's normally what chefs will do in the French cooking. Then we deglaze it with some wine or vinegar or a demi, you know, a stock of some kind, and make our sauce. Well, Paul Bertoli deglazes that with wine or water and does it again. Lets it caramelize again. Then he scrapes it up. He adds more liquid again. He does this four or five times. And now you've created all these layers.
When you're talking about deglazing, that's sort of like that sweet layer of...
All the sticky bits
yeah.
that are kind of on the bottom. And when you scrape those off, the French call it le sucre, S-U-C-S. And it's just this flavor that you can't replace. You can't buy that anywhere.
And it takes time?
Time.
Time.
And patience.
Time seems like a big part of what you put into all of these dishes.
I'm a very impatient person, as most everyone that knows me. And so it's hard for me to stay, you know, in the moment. But you have to, you know, if you're kneading the dough for the pasta, you're rolling it through the machine multiple times. If you're, you know, so yeah, there's plenty of, when you're braising things, you're sauteing something, it's just taking the time to make sure the pan's hot. It's just, there's plenty of instances in our cooking life that we need to be patient and let the flavors develop. And
do you have a very favorite dish to make, whether it's in your restaurant or not?
You know, every Monday and maybe on a Sunday, we roast chicken, and especially in the summertime, we roast chicken, steamed jasmine rice, corn that we cut off the cob and saute with a little bit of butter and chanterelle mushrooms. And maybe we make tomato Provençal, which is...
This is at home, you and your wife?
Yeah. Almost every Monday we have that dish. In fact, I got burned on my face the other day because I splashed myself with oil as I'm basting the chicken in the oven.
Roasted chicken. I mean, that is like such an everyman's dinner.
But when you know, you can talk to the Thomas Kellers of the world and the Daniel Belous of the world, these incredible chefs all over the world, and roast chicken will come. You know, Judy, what's her name out at, there's a chef in San Francisco, and she died of cancer a few years ago, but she did her roast chicken. It's the best roast chicken in America.
What makes a roast chicken great?
Plenty of salt and pepper, some fresh herbs, and maybe a little lemon if you want on top, but you put it in a nice hot oven and let it go and start with a great chicken, you know, start with a great chicken.
So what, can you help me find the parallel between like making a great roasted chicken and making great pasta with squid ink or crispy pig ears or, you know, like some of these things that are a little... further from the everyday experience of home cooks?
Well, so if you're going to cook a pig ear and you don't cook it long enough, it's going to be too chewy to eat, and so you're going to have kind of this mess. If you're roasting a chicken, I mean, it's the same. So if you cook your pig ears long enough, you have to we boil them in water. We don't boil, we simmer them in water and, you know, stock and things like that for maybe 3 or 4 hours, and then we cool them down and slice them really thin. And so that in itself is done. I mean, we've seasoned the water that they're in or the stock, and so they're already a tasty piece. We just fry them and put more salt on them, and that makes them even tastier. But the same thing with the chicken. It's pretty simple. Most everything is salt and pepper, and cooking it correctly to the correct doneness. And then once those components are met, that sort of threshold, then you can create any dish with it.
In the time since you opened Michael Smith Restaurant 10 years ago, how do you think Kansas City's dining community has changed, or Kansas City's restaurant scene has changed? Has it significantly?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, when I got here, you know, we couldn't sell figs. We couldn't sell people squab. Pigeon is probably still the last holdout that's harder to sell, but we couldn't sell a lot of things. And
the pigeon thing, I blame Sesame Street. People see those as pets, you know.
Right. Or the ones that are flying under the bridge and, you know.
Right.
So, anyway.
Pets are pests.
Yeah. But, you know, food is, the palate has changed dramatically. But I think that's also due to these television shows that have shown people that there's these, you know, Anthony Bourdain and these guys are regular guys. They're chefs, but they're regular guys. They're going in these places and they're eating this incredible food. So people are traveling all over. They're eating the food they see on television. They're less afraid. And that's been awesome for our customers, you know.
As you launch into this next thing, this Finding Guido phase, your Italian concept, I don't mean to imply that this is the case, but like a person could ask, especially when you talk about your age and being, you know, that you've got maybe 15 years of hardcore kitchen cooking left in you, seeing this possibly as like the shiny red sports car of the restaurant world, you know what I mean?
I'm having a midlife crisis.
Maybe.
Well, maybe. I just decided that I love, you know, really it started because I was thinking about retirement and where would I retire? And if my wife and I want to retire, where is it that we want to eat the food? What do we crave? And it became about craving food. And so it was going to be Italy. We thought about all the countries. I love all these other foods. I do. But what can I not live without? It's the food from Italy. So I have to be somewhere close to Italy and retire there. And so then I thought, well, if that's how I feel, then I want to cook this.
Yeah, why wait?
Why wait?
So it's like when people tell writers, you've got to write the book you want to read.
Right, right. And, you know, and I sort of kicked myself that I didn't respect and understand Italian food early enough when I was in France and working in Europe at the time, because I just didn't understand it, because in America we saw it as spaghetti and meatballs. We saw Chef Boyardee. We didn't see real, not in places I lived. We didn't see real Italian food, so I didn't have as much experience.
Michael Smith with us from Michael Smith and Extra Virgin and the Crossroads. Thank you.
Thank you.
We spoke with Michael on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of Michael Smith Restaurant and the launch of a new Italian food concept. Up next, a sobering documentary about a growing conflict between workers and elephants on coffee plantations. A local filmmaker has that story. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard.
Several elephants snuck up on us, which I know sounds crazy that elephants can sneak up on someone, but they're really quiet, especially for an animal their size.
That's an agriculture student from the United States. His class went to India to learn about a growing conflict between elephants and coffee plantation workers.
They come storming through the plantations, running over trees, people, whatever's in their way. And that's what makes the elephants so dangerous, is that they don't know that these people are, you know, just doing their jobs or just trying to grow the plantations. All they're seeing is people running at them, shooting firecrackers off.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now a local filmmaker joins us to talk about his documentary, Elephants in the Coffee. Bhaskar DK, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Thank you for having me on the KCUR.
Thanks for being here. There's this whole conflict behind the coffee many of us drink that we don't even know about. Explain it.
You know, on an average in America itself, there is 400 billion cups of coffee every day consumed. But many of us don't know that much of the coffee is also in a conflict zone, particularly in South India, where I come from. Recently, we found that there is almost a direct conflict every day. Either an elephant gets killed or a man gets killed.
So why specifically a conflict between elephants and humans? What is it that's going on that's causing that?
These coffee estates are just around the boundaries of the national park. And elephants do not know that, you know, these are all the growing coffee plantations. They just look at them as natural corridors. And much of these corridors are now the growing plantations.
You know, the elephants in the national park used to exist peacefully side by side with the coffee plantations without going over there, right?
Yes. At one time, you know, there was less population, but, you know, increased conservation efforts have also played a greater role in the preservation of the elephants in the national park.
So there are more elephants?
There are more elephants. Certainly, the conservation efforts have paid rich dividends in these national parks where the population of elephants has phenomenally increased. At the same time, there is also an increased plantations right around it. And the natural corridors are cut off for the elephants. And when they cross over, there is a direct conflict.
And they cross over because, like, just sort of like we would, if there were more people trying to thrive in the same habitat, we might get really hungry for a little extra food and, oh, there's some over there.
Yes, you know, when the elephants continue to think that, you know, it is their right of way to go out of wherever they want. You know, they are large mammals and they need large landscapes. When the landscapes shrink, so they do not understand, yes, I don't have to, they don't have a traffic signal to go this way or that way. They just go the way they want.
And so what happens when they enter the coffee plantations?
Well, you know, the coffee plantations are so dense. Sometimes they just harbor themselves. They just habitat themselves in and around the coffee estates. And during the harvest season, and generally throughout the year, there are people walking in and out of it, particularly in the area that we have filmed. Large part of the coffee estates are owned by individual planters, 10 acres or less. And that makes it very difficult for elephants to identify themselves, whether they are in a large coffee estate or a small coffee estate. For a small coffee farmer, you know, getting damage with this plantation is not possible for him to sustain. So when these elephants go, he tries to push them to the next coffee estate, the next coffee estate, the next coffee estate.
Push them how?
Through either firing firecrackers, or sometimes gunshots, or sometimes making huge loud noises. So there are different kinds of ways in which they try to push the elephant from one estate to the next estate.
There are people dying.
Yes, of course, you know, because when the elephants get pushed, so they are so quiet, you literally can't see them.
That is unbelievable to me that elephants are quiet.
Elephants are so quiet, despite their size and despite the way they move around the coffee estate, until they break something, you won't even know that they are right next to you.
Yikes. So they sneak up on people and people are just stampeded?
Yes. You know, when there are elephants, it could be a small herd of 4 to 5 elephants or sometimes 10 elephants, 11 elephants. So when people are moving in and around the coffee estates for their daily routine, so they cannot identify an elephant at all because of the dense vegetation as well as the silence in which they operate. So when they crisscross between the coffee estates, there are chances that, you know, they somehow come right in front of the elephants. And when they are right in front, there is no way they have an escape route.
So, I mean, people are dying and so are elephants.
Yes. So people are now, so elephant always had a reverence as God, you know. So
explain that a little bit. The elephant has been revered as a god.
So elephant, you know, elephant-headed god Ganesha gets its head from the elephant. So that kind of a reverence is there for the elephant 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
And this is in the Hindu religion?
Hindu religion. So the elephant coming to the plantations and the agricultural field has been going on for 10, 15, 20 years. It is nothing new now. But the fact is that always the farmer had some kind of a reverence to think, even if there is a destruction of his livelihood, he would be tolerant to the destruction, thinking that, oh, maybe, you know, Ganesha has come and he didn't want us to come get all the food produce this year. Maybe our next produce will be much healthier and much better.
Can you tell me more about the god Ganesha?
Lord Ganesha, you know, is the epitome of Hindu religion. So, you know, in the pantheon of gods, there is Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara, and Maheshwara is the destructor of all evil on life. So his wife, Parvati, you know, because he has to take care of the whole world, because he is always looking for the evil part of it. So one day he is outside and Parvati is bored and she feels that she needs some kind of a child. And she creates with her powers a son, and she calls him. She asks one day for him to guard her front door because she wants to go for bath. And when Shiva comes accidentally, he doesn't know that he has a son, and he is not allowed to go inside the house. And in that fit of rage, he takes his sword and cuts off his head. And when Parvati comes out, she is in fury. And she says, you have cut off my son. So for him to make amends with Parvati, he sends his guards in all four ways. And one of them goes in a northerly direction and cuts off an elephant's head and comes back to Shiva. And Shiva puts the head of an elephant on this dead soul and reincarnates and says, you will be the supreme god in all facets of Hindu religion. So today, irrespective of whatever be the festivities or occasion, so Lord Ganesha gets the first reverence.
And so this is, in a way, like there is loss of life, which is always tragic, but there's also this sort of extra poignancy that this is the loss of the life of an elephant, which represents so much in this culture.
Yes. So one soul is dead, but the other soul has got a big reverence. And because of that, because elephant has given its own soul to Ganesha, people believe that today, even if, you know, if if elephant comes, it is almost considered as a reverence to Lord Ganesha.
So, I mean, people are still, I'm feeling, it sounds like it's changed, though, that it used to be that even if your livelihood was threatened, if an elephant came, you wouldn't inflict violence on it. What changed?
No. You know, across the rest of the, you know, many in many parts of the world, there is human-wildlife conflict. There is nothing new about it. But particularly in Asia, with elephants marauding right across the lands, there has always been tolerance. That tolerance is what is changing. In fact, we talk about in the documentary that younger generation do not feel the same way that the adults thought about it, their parents thought about it. So with the younger generation rethinking their strategy about conservation and, you know, their acceptance of elephant coming to the agricultural field, that which is their livelihood, that is the danger part of it. That is the conservation part where we need to rethink about. If the younger generation do not think in the right way, that's going to be dangerous.
If you have a question for Bhaskar Duque about the relationship between the coffee you drink and elephants in India, call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We've got to take a break, but KCUR's Central Standard will be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Bhaskar Duque, an Olathe man originally from India who's out with a documentary called Elephants in the Coffee, about a little-known conflict in India putting both elephants and coffee plantation workers in danger. Hi again, Bhaskar.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about your background.
I am a native of India, and you know, I came to the United States about 10 years ago.
Where in India did you grow up? Tell me about that place.
I grew up in rural India, in southern India. There is a state called Karnataka. And, you know, today Bangalore, the capital city, is the tech world. So if you make a phone call to perhaps Target or United, so invariably the call will go to Bangalore. So it's technology capital. They call it the Silicon Valley of India. And that's where I live now. But I didn't grow up in Bangalore, the big city. But I grew up in rural India, about 4 or 5 hours away from Bangalore. So right on the banks of one of the holy river of South India. They call it the Ganges of the South, Kaveri River. So elephants, I used to hear that was some, you know, occasionally they would say, oh, there are elephants in the outside periphery of the village, so don't go that side. And we would not venture out at all. So, you know, the elephants have come and gone right in and around the villages for many times.
So like elephants are coming, that means stay inside.
They generally not used to come inside. They, you know, I haven't heard many stories from that era when elephants came and had a direct conflict with humans. They would come. They would come sometime, or not so much as it is now, because we have expanded our territory. Human territory has expanded much beyond what it used to be 15, 20 years ago.
What brought you to the United States and to Olathe?
I live in Lenexa.
Oh, Lenexa. Sorry.
That's okay. So it's all part of Greater Metro Kansas.
One Kansas City.
My wife right now is working at KU-Med, so she's a cancer researcher. That's what brought me to Kansas. But I came first to Augusta, Georgia. So from Augusta to Kansas, you know, it has been a small little journey.
What, and you are a filmmaker, photographer, and adventurer, as you put it, right?
Yeah, you know, I never thought I would take a journey like this ever when I was growing up. But, you know, as destiny has it, I have been fortunate to travel the world and work on many different stories. Photography was a passion that I started learning and learned the tricks of the trade much after I graduated. I never had an opportunity to do that kind of thing when I was studying. But, you know, I have been fortunate to travel to some of the most amazing landscapes, from Amazon to the Arctic. And elephants have been my passion for a long time. First, initially, I started working on elephants, on population dynamics, you know, understanding the population growth around particularly India and the rest of Asia. And slowly, I was also involved in radio collaring of the elephants and how radio collaring would give us a real-time data on their home range, their how they travel across the landscape. But as I started working on it, I was also intrigued on the human relationship with the elephants. There is no animal on this planet today which comes as close to elephants in giving that kind of a artistic impression for elephant, for humans. Almost it inspires human mind to think in so many different ways.
What do you think it is about the elephant that does that?
From an 8-month-old baby to an 8-year-old man, you know, anybody who wants to stand in front of an elephant, they bow their head and they want to cuddle an elephant.
What? Everyone wants to cuddle an elephant?
It is so, it's so intriguing for me to think, you know, it's such a large mammal, but when you stand in front of it, you just feel that, you know, you are just right next to your mother or a father or a grandma or a grandpa, some kind of a close affinity to an elephant. And that's what makes it so human. Elephants have a same lifespan as humans. They live for about 70, 80 years. But irrespective of their size, irrespective of their power, when you are in front of it, you don't feel that. You want to hug an elephant. You want to, you know, touch its trunk, touch its tusk. Somewhere you want to get
And you're sure this is everybody?
Everybody, irrespective of whoever it is. You stand in front of a captive elephant, if there is somebody there, you definitely will do it. So, I challenge you on that.
What was it that made you think it was time to turn the camera lens toward not just the elephant, but toward this particular conflict in India between elephants and plantation workers?
The thing is that when there is a conflict, there are casualties on both sides. There are humans being killed and the elephants being killed. So it is a conservation issue. And I felt that there is a compelling narrative for us to put forth in front of the people. And it is not just about an Indian story. It is a global story. When we are talking about polar bears and the shrinking landscape in the Arctic world, it is as much important to talk about elephants too. Because, you know, today the global consumption of coffee, or any, as a matter of fact, anything that we are talking about, everything has a relevance to what we are talking about: shrinking landscape, shrinking resources, and we need to conserve elephants. If you conserve elephants, you are also conserving the large woodlands. And if you conserve the large woodlands, you are automatically giving a landscape for many other living beings to have an equitable space. And that is very critical today for all of us to think.
What is the coffee consumer's role in all of this? I mean, the knee-jerk reaction that I have is to say, okay, don't drink coffee from India, and then you're not complicit. But then, you know, like, I'm not so sure that boycotting people's livelihood really helps anything.
We are certainly not propagating boycotting of coffee at all. In fact, we are promoting a healthy way of looking at it, where we can create a sustainable, equitable space for coffee growers, coffee consumption, as well as elephants. The coffee will, in fact, we talk about in the documentary, the coffee will only taste a little better if we can think of humans as well as elephants on the same platform.
So
coexistence is what we are promoting.
How would that be achieved in this circumstance?
Now, when there is a coffee, when there are elephants intruding into the coffee estate, instead of just blindly chasing them away or having a direct conflict with elephants, there are ways in which you can at least have a tolerable limit. Go get back to that coexistence and say, yes, this is a time when the elephant is there. Maybe, perhaps, I have lost something, but I will also promote a healthy coffee practice. You can charge a little bit more on the coffee side, but people would only accept if they think that, you know, I am having a better coffee growing around my surroundings, at the same time promoting an elephant-friendly habitat.
So the role of the consumer, it sounds like, I mean, the role of the consumer is to become educated enough to accept rising prices or things like that.
You know, sometimes these kind of measures are required. So these would only help us to think more liberatedly about elephants in a coffee land.
Elephants in a coffee land. I mean, when you talk about elephants and you are so impassioned about them and you see meaning ranging from religious meaning to environmental meaning to influence on people's livelihood and economics, you see all of that in an elephant. Plus, you have this just personal affinity for this creature. When in a situation where here in Kansas City, I think most people have so little contact with elephants, so little thought about elephants.
No, for, you know, you mentioned about, you know, getting a produce from coffee produce from India. So the fact is that it is not an Indian problem. It is a global problem. We are only talking right now about a small conflict that is happening in one part of the world. But the human wildlife problem is much bigger. We are talking about coffee today, but there could be something else tomorrow in somewhere else. So in the context of Kansas City, now if suppose Kansas City Zoo has an elephant, they have an African elephant, you'll go to the Kansas City Zoo and stand across the range where elephants are there, you will be amazed how many people just stand and watch for hours and hours and hours. Kids don't want to move. Adults don't want to move. Now, when they all think about the rest of the problem that is happening, they will start thinking about, you know, what can we do? This needs a global movement. It is not relevant to one person or one organization or maybe one area. This needs a participation from all of us to think, yes, there is a problem. How can we all support this? How can maybe technology can come to a solution? Maybe there is a solution in Kansas City on a technology platform. We don't know.
Is that part of why in this documentary, there are many trips to India, and there are students who are there who have gone to India as part of this?
I am a great believer that, you know, younger generation have a solution to the future conservation problem. I think that they have not been exposed enough to understand the problems of it. We are only talking about, oh, okay, you know, maybe in a few years there are no animals in the forest, or maybe some of the species will become extinct. Rather than that, I feel if we give them more opportunities to think of the challenges cannot be just on the textbooks or a few documentaries, but the experiential learning is going to change their whole thinking. I believe the younger generation, today you look at it, there are 8-year-old, 9-year-olds bringing about software applications. They are creating apps. I just saw about a month ago, somebody in Virginia or somewhere, I forget about it. He has created an app to understand how we can attract pollinators to your backyard, you know, through many different applications. So I feel the younger generation have a large role to play if only we give them an opportunity to travel, to experience, and to play an active role in understanding the problems.
And you've taken agriculture students from the United States to India to witness some of this stuff.
When I came to the U.S., I was fortunate to run into a very fine man, a true American, I would say, Tom Grant. And he has been really great support in understanding the visual storytelling aspect of it. And today he is a professor at Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College. He stood with the entire project. And we have taken, it so happened that we are fortunate to take the agricultural students to an agricultural conflict area. But we would like to expand and involve more students. I want to take business students to understand the business implications of this conflict. Management students to understand how they can play a significant role in understanding the problem. Then I want to take sociology students. So there is a solution for everybody to participate.
I loved hearing from the students in the documentary who were like, yeah, they told us if we see an elephant, just hide behind a tree.
Don't do that.
Don't hide behind a tree.
You know, don't even get into that. People have to have a feeling that, you know, if they see an elephant, they can either hide or run away. It's much more complex.
Well, I will take your word for that. Our time is up. We've been talking about a documentary called Elephants in the Coffee. And Bhaskar, will people in Kansas City have the opportunity to see it?
Well, we had just two screenings just now, one in the Valletta Public Library and also in one of the LL Bean retail store. But I am coordinating if I can have it in universities, UMKC probably, KU, and, you know, I've been coordinating.
So we'll keep an eye on the schedules.
Thank you.
Bhaskar DK, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me here. I appreciate that.
You can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we keep all the audio from our past shows, kcur.org/centralstandard. And both talk shows at KCUR will be broadcasting live from Park University in the hours leading up to the total eclipse on Monday. So if you aren't able to make it to the Path of Totality, you can listen in, or maybe we'll see you there. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman.